ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, this is a content warning because the following show contains adult concepts and language.
Turn up the volume. We're like, that's not realistic. It's like...
So it's like flapping.
Silicone flapping. So many conversations. Too wet, too dry. Like, there was so many conversations about these toes.
I'm Beverly Wang, and it's time to stop everything and get smarter about pop culture together. And this episode, we are talking about family, belonging, race, identity, comedy, creativity, and sex with award-winning playwright and actor Ra Chapman. Welcome, Ra.
Hi, Beverly.
Ra, you're the star and creator of a brand new ABC comedy called White Fever. It's very, very funny. All episodes are on ABC iView now for you to binge for free.
Binge it.
Binge it, binge it, binge it. Here's a little taste of what that sounds like.
You know, you've never dated a person of colour before, so you just wouldn't get it.
Hang on, isn't Jane a person of colour?
I have so dated a person of colour. You know, what about Debbie Dukas's brother, Steve's?
You mean Stavros? He was Greek.
Oh, come on. He was extremely tanned.
See, everything is a joke to you, Jane. Being with an Asian man is really different to being with a white man, but that's just something you'll never really understand.
Ra, you are the series lead. You play Jane Thomas. Mm-hmm. And in that clip, your best friend, Edie, she's white.
Mm-hmm.
You're Asian.
Yes.
And she's saying to your character in that clip that basically you have no idea what it's like to date a person of color.
Yes.
This is a bit of a funny reversal going on.
Yes.
There. Can you explain what is going on in White Fever?
Wow, that's a big question. That scene was a very tricky and complex scene because there is a lot of kind of reversal going on there. Like when we were filming it, I feel like Katie Robertson, who's an amazing actor, I think she felt deeply uncomfortable. And lucky she's a brilliant actor and can get through it. I guess also you just said that, you know, Jane is an Asian woman, but also she doesn't see herself as Asian. So there's kind of like a lot of
stuff
going on
there. There's a lot happening
there. There is. It's like she's being told that she's a person of colour also later by Gabby, one of the friends, and that she's never dated a person of colour. And I think there's a little bit of like farcical kind of stuff going on there.
And then there's a part where the friend Edie says, Jane's whiter than most white people.
Yes.
Which is pretty rough to say to someone's face.
It's so rough, but also Jane in the past has called herself, I'm whiter than most white people, ha ha ha, because I guess that's a phrase that comes out of her mouth now because she is so used to being a white person, and also aligning herself with whiteness has always been a good thing in the past.
Yeah, so White Fever, the series, is about your character Jane Thomas, who is a Korean adoptee.
Mm-hmm.
Moved to Australia as a toddler and lives in a fictional town called Mount Whiteman.
Yes.
She has white fever. And white fever, in this case, is her deep sexual attraction to big, hairy white guys.
Yes.
And she has kind of this revulsion to Asian men.
Yeah.
When I watched it, I was like, this woman's going through a psychological breakdown as she tries to cure herself from white fever. And also, she's trying to figure out what's encapsulated there. Is she white? Is she Asian? Mm. How does being a Korean transracial adoptee, I guess, how is that part of her white fever? Has that fed into it? That's one part of it, but just figuring herself out.
Yeah, like growing up in the 90s in a country town was the case for a lot of Korean, I'll talk specifically about Korean adoptees, but transracial adoptees in Australia during that time. And normally, you know, they were raised in white Caucasian families. And so you grow up and everywhere you look are white people. Everywhere you go and the people you love the most and all around you and that you see 24 hours a day are your white family. So for you not to kind of internalize that, or whether it's consciously or subconsciously, and want to be white or be repressing parts of you that are quote-unquote Asian, I think is a really common thing for not just adoptees, but people growing up in that time in Australia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. You don't have to be adopted by a white family to wish that you were a little blonde girl whose name was Cindy, which literally is like part of my own personal history at some point in my life. But Ra, this is a deeply personal work because you are a Korean adoptee to Australia. You came here at the age of four. Do you mind just sort of sharing your story?
So my family came over from Australia to Korea to come and get me. They saw how I was living. So I was in foster care at the time. So they met my Korean foster mother. And mind you, I can't remember any of this. This is just from photos. I'm like, I remember that, but I'm like, no memory. So they came and got me and brought me back to Australia, where apparently I picked up English so quickly. I assimilated really quickly. I was a really happy child. And a little bit of context with that is when they got photos sent of me before they came to pick me up, I was like, looked really sad. Mm. I was like pouting and I had a lopsided haircut. So they were just like, oh my gosh, we're getting this poor little sad child. And then when they met me in Korea, they're like, who's this? But I also think that a lot of adoptees, you know, a lot of us are people pleasers. And it's not just adoptees, you know what I mean? Like, so I also am interested in how much of that is like, oh, I better make these people like me. And I guess I'm going to this new country and you land in this new country. I better learn the language because I can't communicate with anyone. Where I grew up, there was no Korean speaking that I knew of people.
So you don't remember any of your first 4 years of life?
No.
What was your sense of Asianness then in that context growing up in sort of regional South Australia?
You can probably guess.
I'd love you to tell me in your own words.
I wanted just to look like everyone around me. And also, my sister, the biological child, she is like this beautiful, long-legged, blonde person. And then there was me, like short, you know, stumpy little Asian
compact
girl. Compact, sturdy, strong, all the good things. And so I wanted to be like her. I wanted to be like my friends at school. It's a classic case, isn't it? Like, this story's been told so many times, but I guess it's like there's so many different specific experiences where you're a migrant, whether, you know, you grew up in white spaces, whether you're adopted.
Yeah. But how was your Korean identity? Like, was that something that your family made efforts to explain to you and reflect back to you or keep a connection there? Or like, because I'm just thinking it's the 90s. The white Australia policy dominated the like three quarters of the 20th century. The 90s is one nation, Pauline Hanson, swamped by Asians. How do you see all of that context also fitting into you being basically placed down right in the middle of it?
They're two bigger questions. My little brain goes,
you came to talk about a TV show, but I'm asking you about politics and history.
Exactly. Well, let's just say this, you know, inter-country adoption, let's specifically say, I don't know if I've got my facts right. You know, I have a lot of adoptee friends that are academics in this area, so they can correct me. But the White Australia policy, it's really like, I believe, about 4 years after White Australia policy was abolished. And was that
in the mid-70s,
76 or something. Roughly. It was only 3 or 4 years after that inter-country adoption became a thing. Mm-hmm. So you've only got like a couple of years and then people are adopting Asian babies, where 3 or 4 years ago, we didn't want them in Australia. So that's a really short amount of time.
Bit of a whiplash.
The social consciousness to change that much. And the short answer is it didn't change that much. It can't. You know, that's a slow process. So being adopted during that time and like those early adoptees and all through that time is, I think there was a wrestle. And I think also it was a lot of the narrative of, you know, we're adopting these children to save them, to help them. And so I think that creates a very certain dynamic.
So the inter-country transracial adoption, of which Korea has been a huge source of children overseas, I think I saw an estimate up to 200,000 children from Korea have been adopted overseas. So this is a global phenomenon.
Yeah. And the adoptee communities in the US, in Canada, in Europe, huge compared to Australia, you know? And so it's something that I feel like the Australian consciousness and the adoptee communities, because there are lots of them, you know, there's organisations in Australia, but because of our populations, our politics here in Australia, in regards to the kind of stories we tell and the narratives and the research, we are a little bit behind other countries because of so many reasons. But, you know, we are growing here in Australia. Like, we've got podcasts now, Adoptee Feels, that is an Australian Korean adoptee podcast. We have White Fever, we've got plays, we've got essays. So it's definitely growing.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about White Fever then, because I am even just thinking back to, like, the basics. Like, when you are pitching not a documentary, which is maybe what people might think that you might want to do about being a Korean adoptee. Like, let me go back and find this and, you know, talk about all the facts. What you're pitching is like this zany, quite sex-focused comedy.
Mm. Yeah. I should have done a doco, It would have been easier. Not saying doco's easy, sorry.
When you were pitching this, I wonder, like, what was the response? Did anybody ever be like, oh, nice idea, but so niche? Like, what kind of feedback were you getting in terms of this idea of yours?
Yeah. It actually surprised me how on board everyone was. They're like, oh my God, that's so funny. And when I say so funny, I mean, I guess we made sure, and we were commissioned by ABC Comedy, that the hairy white man thing was the premise.
Right.
Because obviously, if you watch the show, as the series goes along, it unpacks so many other things unexpectedly. But the premise is this little Asian woman, she doesn't even think she's Asian. Oh my God, she's obsessed with hairy white men. I mean, people like, oh my God, that hits all the zeitgeist things. But I think that really is just a window into kind of deeper stuff. But yeah, look, that in a lot of ways wasn't a hard pitch, to be honest.
Thank goodness for Harry White Guys getting White Fever
on
the line.
They got the show greenlit. Thank you, Harry White Man. So much love for you.
I think it's such an ambitious series and congratulations on it, because you have this wild humor. You have Jane, who's a basket case. You've got your best friend, Edie, who is walking this path where she's very earnestly and sincerely marrying her Hmong fiancé. Mm. And then there's all sorts of side stories and timelines.
Yeah.
What did you want people who either don't know about this phenomenon at all, because I think it's a comedy, and all of a sudden they're plunged into your character's search and quest and just figuring the stuff out. What do you want them to understand about the experience of Korean adoptees told via Jane, who's just one character?
I'm going to go to tone and rhythm. I know that seems like a bizarre segue, but I wasn't so keen to give a lot of information. Like, you can Google, you know what I mean? You can read stuff. So with the show, what we really wanted to do and what I was really obsessed with achieving was trying to capture the ephemeral. And what I mean by that is, like, how does it feel to start to question your identity? How does it feel to, like, have kind of not thought about things for your whole life and then have things thrown at you by your friends? And then also this deep thing inside you start to surface, these feelings, memories, past, that you're not prepared for. What does that feel like? And I guess for me personally, a lot of the things in my own journey as an adoptee, because plot-wise it's very fictional, but in regards to some of the nature and feelings of the experience, they're very personal. And so the fact that it goes from, like, wild, silly comedy, everything's fine, everything's cool, Jane's on top of it, she's a little bit of a loose cannon, but she's great, into quickly into, like, something that's quite unsettling, and someone says something or she thinks of something and it's a bit of a rug pull, like that visceral sensation. So in regards to the rhythm and the tone and those wild kind of shifts, that's actually because we wanted to emulate the kind of...
It's like a roller coaster, really.
Roller coaster.
Up and down.
And the unexpected things, you're like, I never thought of that before.
And you acting that on top of, you know, writing it. Did that bring up anything for you?
The development and writing this and rewriting, you know, you always get notes and you're rewriting, and that sometimes was quite an emotional or psychologically straining process. And also, like, the main team on White Fever, amazing team, but they're not adoptees, and there's one Asian Australian identifying person on the team. So there is a lot of explaining, there's a lot of rewriting. And to be honest, sometimes I'll be like, I shouldn't have to explain myself. But the fact is, I was making something for a wider audience. I wanted people to be able to take away things. So it was really important. But to be honest, it was really tough sometimes. And also writing those scenes, sometimes they upset me. But on set, it's so fast. You know, it's a comedy. It's not like we get 12 takes and it's luxurious. It's like, wham, bam, thank you, ma'am. And so really in the scene, because I wrote it and because I had it in my body and it was actually an emotion or a psychological state that I was trying to portray, luckily we had done so much work already on it that when it came to shooting and it was so fast that a lot of it was in my body.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a lot of the story, some of the biographical details of Jane's life do echo yours.
Yeah.
But it's obviously, you know, you were also adopted at the age of four. Mm-hmm. You lived in not Mount Whiteman, but Mount Gambier, yes, <yeah. laughs> which is a good name, by the way. But in terms of, like, making sure that you were consulting with different adoptees and channeling their experiences as well, how many people did you talk to or consult with to get across that?
Quite a few people. And I'll just talk about a few specifics, the adoption stuff, you know. I am kind of very active in the adoption community and could kind of draw from a lot of different resources. We had a friend of mine called Ryan, and Ryan also is one of the hosts of Adoptee Feels. Shout out. Amazing podcast. Sorry, Beverly.
No, that's okay.
Another podcast.
There could be lots of podcasts in the world. There are.
There's enough for everyone.
Yeah, yeah.
So I talked to a lot of the adoptees while I was developing, but then we formally brought him on board to be a consultant to, like, read some of the scripts for us just to chat about it. That was really great, and for me to just check in and go, what do you think? Because all adoptees are so different, and this is a very particular story, but I still wanted, and I thought it's important to have other people's feedback. So also my adoption social worker, who's a Korean woman who lives in Australia, so she moved to Australia and became a social worker. That is so rare and lucky. Before then, all my social workers in Australia weren't Korean. So the fact that I have a Korean social worker in Australia is amazing. So, you know, I've been back to Korea with Sue, and she's translated for me with my birth father. And so she's really gone above and beyond. And I think without people like Sue, it does feel really lonely, and it does feel like you don't have access to people that understand, that are in the system. So Sue also consulted, like, the specificity of certain things in regards to adoption and the processes, like that envelope.
With the letter.
So that's kind of based on my own letters from my birth father and that side of the family. But with Sue, I was like, what does this thing right here say? So she was translating, but also going, oh, that means that they've stamped it to acknowledge receipt, and this other stamp means that, oh, they've processed it on this level and now they're filing it. So it was so interesting. I learned a lot. I've had these letters for so long, and I even learned a lot during this process because we were trying to be so specific with everything in the show.
Jane's dad, I think, is a really interesting character in White Fever because he has such a close bond with Jane. It's obviously a really loving experience, but then when you talk about the rug pull, there are so many moments where that character is used to show how that is. Like, he deeply loves his daughter, but right alongside it is, like, constantly delivering these, like, microaggression lines about Asian things. Like, when he kept saying cheap Chinese shit, you know, it was like, yeah, I've been there when someone has said that kind of stuff in my presence. And even if you're not Chinese, people aren't being like, oh, well, she's Korean. Like, they're just, it's like, it all hits us the same way.
And the karate chops to the boy, a little bit more subtle, but kind of not subtle.
No, you're like, very kind of like real life feelings hitting there. But I think that speaks to that tough position that you and other adoptees must occupy, you know, living in loving families, but there's this fundamental disconnect happening.
Yeah, and I think for each adoptee, it's so different. You know, some adoptees' parents are super woke and some not. For us, we chose for Jane. I really love that. And the nature of the show is that kind of everything's fine, rug pull. And so it was important for the dad to really be a beautiful, loving, supporting dad, but have this massive blind spot, because why does Jane also not think she's Asian? A lot has to do with because her dad doesn't think that she's Asian. So when he's saying these things, doesn't even cross his mind that that's going to upset his daughter. Yeah. And I think when I was growing up, like, you know, some people would say something maybe racist or even just like commenting on something Asian. They're like, oh, but not you, Ra, or you're different, or you're not even Asian or stuff. And I would be so happy and proud. I'd be like, that's right, I'm not, you know, I'm special.
Oh my God.
I'm like basically white, you know.
I'm just like thinking about all the therapy.
Yes.
All of the yes. No, I'm not
therapy
talking about you.
Good.
I'm just saying, just clutching my own head thinking
it's
about that.
It's such a head fuck.
It is a head fuck.
We use that term so much in white fever and development and talking to other people is because that's the thing. It's like, what it does to your mind, and, you know, you were saying how it's like Jane's having a mini breakdown, kind of, but also, like, stemming from the situation she's been in for a long time and the things that are happening around her, like, that is cray-cray making.
We have very different life experiences. Mm. I grew up in a very Asian part of North America in Vancouver, but when I was a young reporter, I moved to the state of New Hampshire. At that time, it was, like, among the three whitest states in the United States. I looked it up. And the only other Asian people in that city were the Taiwanese woman who ran the Chinese restaurant. I had to stop taking her calls because she was always aggressively trying to hook me up with people, and it made me deeply uncomfortable. Like, she would harass me with phone calls.
Oh my God,
there
amazing.
Was the Chinese family that ran the Japanese restaurant. Then there were some law students. And anybody would see me like, are you a law student? Because they could not fathom what the hell I was doing there,
doing?
Right? And then the only Asian children I ever saw living in New Hampshire had white parents. And I would see them in the supermarket. From a distance, I would always be like, oh, how interesting. Like,
yeah.
To me, I was instantly fascinated because that's not how I grew up. But I was just recognizing this child and thinking about, what's it like for her?
Mm.
And then it was like, would there just be like a moment where you might pass by? I'm projecting, clearly, because of my own curiosity and fascination.
I love this. Continue.
And I would just feel like there would be a little moment where I might look at the girl and she might look at me and be like, I see you.
Mm.
And then maybe the parents might see me. And I'd be like, I wonder what the parents are thinking right now. It's like, is that what my daughter's going to be like when she grows up? Or whatever. I guess I'm wondering what that might have been like from the perspective of the little girl.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And maybe if we say the little girl back then also in the 90s or something, but even now, if that little girl was me and I was like, maybe say 8-year-old looking at you, I would probably like pretend I didn't see you because I would have felt like, oh my gosh, there's another Asian person that makes me feel deeply uncomfortable and kind of reminds
showing
me.
Showing me up.
Yeah, it's a little bit exposing. I know that sound, that's a little bit, again, like a bit of a head fuck, but I think every
time get it. Yeah.
I saw an Asian person, especially if they were speaking their language, that would kind of freak me out, or I just pretend to not notice it. But if I then heard you speaking with a Western accent,
yeah.
So American, Canadian,
yeah.
Australian accent, then I probably would have studied you and gone, is that what I'm going to be like when I grow up? But if you had spoken in any language that wasn't English, I'd be like,
yuck,
no,
go
no,
away.
No,
yeah, I'm
no,
not like you. Yeah.
Yeah.
Gee whiz.
Yeah.
Gee whiz. There's so, there's a lot. Back to white fever then. Let's just lift the mood. I want to ask about, okay, there's a preoccupation with dolls in this series.
Oh, yeah.
Two dolls,
yes.
In fact, who play pivotal roles.
Yes.
One is the terrifying Cindy with the blonde hair.
Yeah.
Who comes to life. And then there is a lovely Asian gentleman. That your character named Songju and is a pivotal part of Jane trying to cure her white fever. And Songju is a life-size Asian male sex doll that Jane spends a lot of time with.
Oh, Songju.
Here's the thing. I bet it's really easy to find a life-sized Asian female sex doll.
Yes.
Sadly, for many reasons
yes.
That we're not going to get into here. But I was like, I bet it's really hard to find a life-sized Asian male sex doll.
Yeah, it was quite tricky. A lot of them look mixed race. So I was like, are they Asian or they look too Eurasian? And like the conversations we had about sex, it's ridiculous. So I was trying,
does
I need one that looks
doll
more
look like
Asian.
He has like a white grandmother somewhere?
Yes. Yes, like the one we chose was probably the most Asian that
it's,
I was like,
it's,
he's
I'm
the most
almost
Asian.
Feeling
Kid
outraged
him.
Now because there aren't enough people with the Asian male fetish to represent Asian male
know,
sex dolls
like,
more fully.
Don't fetishize us. But we want to be fetishized as much as everyone else is. So, this is
so there's
weird.
A good variety.
We found this one website that had a few different Asian males, but again, we tried to choose the one that was the most Asian.
The most Asian. And then looking, that's a weird metric too, because what are you like, looking at his eyes?
I know.
It's really messed up.
I know. There should have been a behind the scenes about Timmy / Songju because there was so much involved.
If you watch the series, I think one of the best comedic touches is the wiggly silicone toes.
Oh my gosh.
That jiggle.
We spent hours on that. So that wasn't scripted, but when we got the doll and everyone would see the toes and go, oh, so we're like, oh, we have to put that in. And then in sound design, we're like, they have to make a noise.
The toes
have to make a noise. And we're like, turn up the volume. We're like, that's not realistic. It's not the point. It's like...
So it's like flapping.
Silicone flapping. So many conversations. Too wet, too dry. Like, there was so many conversations about these toes.
How memorable.
Yeah.
Okay. And where's dear Timmy now?
Dear Timmy is at home. My home.
Wait.
Everyone, don't jump to any sorted conclusions.
Where is he being stored?
Well, it was in our spare room and now we've moved it out to the back because also it's haunting.
Is he in a box?
He's in his box. You know that
it's
box
like
you
coffin.
See in the show? I know. He's in his little coffin. It is really sad. It feels wrong. I feel like...
So is he with you for life? What's going on?
Know.
What do you do with a life-sized Asian male sex doll?
We could on-sell it because it's clean.
It's famous now.
I swear it's famous. It's clean.
Is there a special significance to the dolls that you had a couple of them in the series?
Yes. Objectification is a massive thing that's happening in this show because just because Jane's Asian herself doesn't mean it's not problematic objectifying another race or
I felt a little bit icky when she was like mounting the Asian male doll and all sorts of stuff because he was so lifeless. It was like,
Exactly. They're kind of avatars because Jane can't deal with herself and real humans. That's why there's the childhood doll. Here's a sex doll.
Mm.
So sad. Poor Jane.
I mean, Jane has a lot going on because at first she isn't able to find Chris Pang sexually attractive, which is speaks to some kind of disturbance of the mind.
Well, this is the thing. Like, a lot of people are like, of course, that makes sense. Because if you cast someone extremely handsome as Yu Chang, then everyone's going to go, okay, I see now she's got a problem.
Look, it's a great series. It lives on forever. So it's going to hit a lot of spots. So big congratulations on that. I really think that people should go watch it and have a good time as well as watching and thinking about the hugely complex experience of being a Korean adoptee. Tell me a little bit about your internet habits. What kind of online lady are you?
I'm an absent online lady.
What do you mean by that?
And that's going to change. Now I'm not working 24 hours a day on this show. But the thing that I do love, and I have loved for years and years, if I am so stressed and I just need to vague out, I love the tiny kitchen cooking videos.
Yeah.
They are so good. And they're so advanced now. Like 4 years ago, you know, there was only a few. There are so many.
So if you haven't seen this, what does it look like?
It's like tiny, like, Barbie-sized kitchens, and they're fully functioning, like the little tap works, the little stove works. They're normally got a tea light in there to cook, so you can bake tiny cakes or you can cook a tiny stove with tiny,
I've seen some of these. They're quite fascinating. And they use real ingredients.
They use real ingredients.
And they cook things.
They cook things.
I mean, I don't know what's happening between the cuts, but they make it look like it's real things. I'm continually fascinated by how do they make the tiny egg that they fry?
I know.
Is that a real egg with a little yolk
in
it?
Quail egg.
How do you make that?
Like, some of them are fake. You can tell by the cuts, but others, you see them crack the egg and the egg comes out. I don't know if they're quail eggs or some other little baby eggs.
But it's even tinier.
The lengths they go to is what I love. I'm thinking of, as a treat for myself for finishing White Fever, I'm thinking of buying my own tiny kitchen. And you can buy the tiny little sharp knives and tiny chopping boards.
Can I make a suggestion?
What?
You've got a very expensive doll just collecting dust. Maybe you could on-sell that and use the proceeds to buy yourself a tiny kitchen. And then you start up, I don't know, like Ra's Tiny Kitchen.
My next project.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Whole series. Yeah.
That's genius.
So, dear Timmy...
Dear Timmy.
Okay, tiny kitchens. What about TV? Like, you make TV, but do you have time to watch TV?
No. But I had did binge Gen V, which is a spin-off of The Boys. Mm-hmm. Have you watched
The Boys? I don't know anything about it. I know that The Boys is something to do with superheroes living the real world. It's kind of violent.
Mm.
That's the extent of it.
Yeah.
Tell me more.
It's very subversive. It's very smart. It's pulpy. And it tackles, like, massive themes, like race and, like, power and responsibility, all the things, like, that superhero movies are supposed to do. But putting them in a real-life situ, which is, like, with that power and unbridled leeway to do what you want, some of the superheroes are extremely problematic, using their powers willy-nilly.
Yeah, what if you're a superhero and you're kind of an asshole?
Exactly.
You're selfish.
Exactly. What if you have these powers and you're
lock
a sex
them
pest?
Up.
Exactly. And this is what happens in the show. It's that thing, should we lock them up, shouldn't we, all that kind of stuff. Gen V, it's actually people at university. So there's, you know, a black woman as the protagonist. There's, you know, a gender fluid character that literally, you know, one of their powers is to change gender, which their parents hate. There's another character that's like, Little Cricket is their stage name, but by vomiting can make herself really small and cute and desirable. And
yeah, that's interesting too. Like, what do you have to invoke your superpower by doing something painful to yourself?
This show is so tragic and so funny. Like, it's so bombastic and so ridiculous and gory and silly, but it's really tragic.
Okay. Good recommendation
you
when you're
watch
feeling.
It. It's a lot, though. It's
yeah.
a lot, be warned.
Okay, I'm not going to watch that close to bedtime. That's like daytime viewing situation.
Oh, God, it's yeah. so stressful.
I need to watch some tiny cooking before bedtime.
Yes.
On Stop Everything, we always say better out than in. What do you want to get off your chest?
It's off my chest, but it's also just like a really interesting wondering that I have when I walk around. But public displays of affection, like, let's face it, they're a bit gross, you know? Like, you see someone...
Says you, Ra Chapman.
Yeah, I'm like, I'm such a prude. No, but you see people kissing and pashing on the street and you're like, get a room, you know? Like, come on. But then you see someone fighting on the corner and you're like, they're having a fight. Oh, well, you know, they'll...
So we normalize...
It. Yeah.
Like aggression and fighting were
yeah.
okay, but for some reason showing affection.
Showing love, Beverly. Why is showing love in public kind of a no-no?
And okay, so are you pro PDA? Because you just...
Yeah, look, basically what I'm saying is I didn't love it and now I'm so into it. So, and my gripe though with myself is like, there's a part of me that resists it, that I'm like, Ra, force yourself to watch those people and love it and go, they are spreading love. Their energy and their vibes are like putting love into the world and not like those people screaming at each other or like bitching to each other on the street corner.
So you're just like, if you see a couple making out on the street corner, Ra Chapman just like standing like really close to them watching.
I might even clap or like give him a thumbs up.
Okay, like, so then the creeper? Wider message to... The listening public is,
yes,
we should all be a bit more supportive of PDA.
Yeah, yeah. Force yourself. Like Jane, you just got to really
grab
change.
That bull by the horns.
Change is hard.
And just watch people make out
yes.
on the street corner.
And then eventually we'll see people go, oh, that's so nice. That's so lovely. You know, with everything going on in the world, this is what we
you
should
know
be
what?
Encouraging. It
okay.
feels uncomfortable.
So as a culture, we need to get over this.
We need to get over it.
Okay, pro-PDA culture is what you want to say.
Yeah.
I love that. I love that. Ra Chapman, thank you so much for stopping everything with me. It's been a real roller coaster of a conversation. I've loved it. We've gone high, low, deep.
Deep. Stop it, Beverly.
The full series of White Fever is on ABC iView now, so you can go watch it and binge it. If you prefer to wait on a weekly basis, it's on Wednesday nights on ABC TV. Parcel it out for yourself. Same with Stop Everything. We are also available and ready to be recommended to whoever you like. So if you enjoyed this conversation, please tap share now and send us to a friend who you think will enjoy a weekly debrief on everything, burning up your feed. Ra Chapman, thank you so much for chatting.
Thanks,
stopping
Beverly.
By. It's been great.
It.
This episode of Stop Everything was made on the land of the Kulin Nation, on Whadjuk Noongar country, and on the land of the Muwinina people from country around Nipaluna. Sarah Mashman produces the show. Tom Wright is the executive producer. And David LeMay is our sound engineer. I'll catch you next time. Bye!
안녕히 가세요!